Good evening. Welcome to Donnell. My name is Marie Nestis. I'm head librarian of Donnell Media Center, which is one of the specialized divisions of the New York Public Library, which resides here in Donnell. The Media Center holds the central film and video collections of the New York Public Library. We have an intriguing evening planned for you. I'd like to begin the proceedings by calling your attention to the work of art that has set the theme for this evening's presentation. That is Nora Ligurano and Marshall Reese's Free Speech Zone on exhibit in the outside display windows of this building. Donnell Media Center has, by now, a 15-year tradition of commissioning video and multimedia installations for exhibition in Donnell Library Center's street-level display windows. With funding from the New York Council on the Arts, the Media Center has been able to provide annual, or at times biennial, installation works made by a range of first-rank media artists. Ms. Ligurano and Mr. Reese have created two works for Donnell's windows. They frequently concern themselves in their work with issues that relate to libraries. In 1994, they transformed the entrance of Donnell into a large and beautiful book for their work, Acid Migration of Culture. This year, they have confirmed Donnell's status as a free speech zone with another dramatic work. It is my great pleasure to introduce to you Marshall Reese and Nora Ligurano.
So let's see if we can do this. Can we share this?
Yeah, of course.
Okay, we're gonna try and share this mic here. Thank you very much, Marie, and thank you everyone for coming out tonight. We also would like to thank Anne Hoffman, who is the chief librarian, who is obviously made this work possible. Marie and her staff in the Media Center, as well as Barbara Wing and Jay Kaplan from the Brooklyn Public Library, and also the people who are the subjects of the portraits. They are Tosi Kapazuka, Lisa Morris, Andreas Campoverde, and Ella Buchan Peak.
And we'd also like to thank the sponsoring organizations who helped organize the reading tonight and some of the people involved. Svetlana Mintrova from the National Coalition Against Censorship, Anna Kushner of the Pan American Center, and Chris Finan of the American Booksellers Foundation for Free Expression.
So I have a question for the audience. Does anybody out there know how to cook a frog?
I do, Norm.
Oh, you do?
It's quite simple, really. You take the little frog and you set it in a pot of tepid water on the stove, not too hot, not too cold, just right. And very gradually, very slightly, raise the temperature gently, 1 degree at a time.
And if you do it slowly enough and you do it subtly enough, the little frog just sits there in a nice warm bath as the water gets hotter and hotter. And before you know it, voila, you have poached grenouille hollandaise, or you have a boiled frog to perfection.
We tried this recipe once,
and you're right. And except the problem was when we raised the temperature and we looked into that pot and we saw the face of that little frog, we suddenly realized to our horror, yikes, you know, we saw ourselves and we said, we're the frog.
And so right then and there, we rescued the frog and resuscitated it.
Marshall gave it mouth to mouth.
And it regained its life, and we set it out into a pond where it lives to this day, happily ever after. And we realize, bit by bit, that our freedoms are being taken away from us, just like you cook a frog. There is soft censorship.
For example, maybe a particular book is questionable for children. Now, you can buy it at Barnes & Noble's, or maybe you can buy it on Amazon, but should it be in a library or in a classroom?
No, I don't think so.
But is that okay? I mean, as long as you can buy it, should you find it in a library? Or there's also hard censorship.
You know, with September 11th, everyone knows the importance of safety. We all need to be safe again. But there's a lot of hazardous information out there. especially libraries, even libraries like this, very accessible to bad folks, to evildoers. And maybe, just maybe, we should check up and see what they're looking at, what they buy, what they read. That's not too much to ask for, is it? I mean, after all, it's for everybody's safety and well-being. And, you know, on top of it, it's patriotic, too, to watch our other citizens and make sure they're not doing something that might endanger the rest of us, right?
Well, you know, as we gradually and imperceptibly come to accept these small changes, we're like our little frog in the pot, you know. Our liberties are just slowly being boiled away. And I can tell you one thing, that the chefs at the White House and Congress and even perhaps the courts are not looking at what is at the end of their forks quite the same way that we are.
And so our motivation for making the installation Free Speech Zone that you walk through tonight to enter the library comes from our concern for keeping our rights to be able to have the freedom to read and the freedom of information. Let's look at the title. What's a zone?
How about the green zone?
You mean in Baghdad?
Yeah.
But Nora?
Well, it isn't really green. I mean, it's not lush. It's a desert. And if green means safe, well, it's not really safe.
Yeah, right.
How about the demilitarized zone?
You mean between North and South Korea?
Yeah.
Well, Nora, I mean, that's not really demilitarized. I mean, it's a narrow stretch of land between North and South Korea, but there's barbed wire and armies and sentry points all along its length. Mm. What about a free speech zone?
Exactly, a free speech zone. Well, it seems to be the opposite of what it really is. I don't know if you remember last year when the RNC was occupying Madison Square Garden, and in fact, our Mayor Bloomberg had declared Flushing, Queens to be the designated free speech zone. So this is true. So how far away can you get from Manhattan to express your free speech?
So here in the library, free speech zone has a particular meaning. Why library, you may ask?
Well, you know, our work actually has centered around libraries and library collections for a number of years. And actually, we've done a lot of works that have to deal with the materiality of books and the importance of libraries as social institutions as well.
Right. And for us, what makes the Donnell an interesting site is one of the reasons they have like an outstanding program for media art. And the installations here for, as Marie said, 15 years have really been an important place for artists to experiment and show their work.
But also, the Donnell is noted for its children's collection, its children's book collection, and also its location, because it is in its proximity to four major museums within one block. And as a matter of fact, it faces the Museum of Modern Art, which we all know is a renowned museum. And one of our friends said to us as we were setting up the installation in our studio, and we were saying, well, we're going to do this at the Donnell, and da, da, da. And they said, so you're finally showing at MoMA.
Right, and so we chose the library as a public site because its mandate is free expression. It's one of the remaining frontiers of free expression and access to information in our country.
And in the installation of Free Speech Zone, you'll see that there are these portraits that make up the piece, and that we actually asked people who were users of the library to be the subjects of those portraits so that we could connect the library community to the issue of free speech and as well, you know, to the piece itself.
And yet, these same portraits are all blindfolded. They're unable to read. They're cut off from information. So what does that say? And also, on top of that, is the outrage of seeing such images in the aftermath of Camp Gitmo, renditions of foreign nationals, and Abu Ghraib.
Our liberties are under attack. So the question is the library really able to act as a free speech zone?
And we can say, thanks to the dedication of librarians all across the country, yes, for now, but always what will happen in the future. Let's take a moment to talk about the installation. When you're outside looking at it, you'll see phrases of censored and banned books on one side and titles on the other. You'll read excerpts like this from poet Allen Ginsberg's Howl.
Angel-headed hipsters burning from the ancient heavily connection to the starry dynamo in the machinery of night. And also from Harry Potter and the Sorcerer's Stone.
He brought the umbrella swishing down through the air to point at Dudley. There was a flash of violet light, a sound like a firecracker, a sharp squeal, and the next second, Dudley was dancing on the spot with his hands clasped over his fat bottom.
Fat Bottoms. As artists, we feel, Marshall and I feel, as though it is probably very important for us at this stage, and also it's very challenging for us to work with public institutions outside the realm of museums and galleries so that we can connect with a different public.
And so in preparing for the talk, we found this article by critic Eleanor Hartney called The New Social Sculpture, and it seemed to be pertinent to what we're doing here. And she writes, in contrast to the art market, public art begins to feel like the last battleground of the avant-garde. Here, artists may touch upon vital human issues and interact with a broad, unjaded general audience. This new public art seems to respond to the German artist Joseph Beuys' call for an art that releases energy in people, leading them to a general discussion of actual problems. And that would mean the cultivation of relations between various people, almost as an act of life.
And so tonight, we wanted to give a voice to the words that you see in the facade of the library, the free speech zone, and to let the authors speak the words themselves. And we are very pleased and very honored to have these outstanding writers read from their banned and challenged works tonight.
So I hope you'll join us in welcoming the writers and the director of the National Coalition Against Censorship, Ms. Joan Burton. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you all. It's really a pleasure and an honor to be here celebrating, as it were, Banned Books Week at the library. A few years ago, the Modern Library Association issued a list of its choices for the 100 best novels of the 20th century. Of the top 10 on the list, 7 had been banned. 25 of the top 50 were banned. Overall, nearly a third of the books on the list were banned at one time or another, and many more were challenged. This is by way of saying that I'm honored to be in the company of this panel of acclaimed authors who are among the larger, distinguished company of censored authors. Each year, we have new reasons to worry about the state of intellectual freedom in the United States, the country that prides itself on its protection for the right to think, read, and speak freely. Not long ago, Harry Potter books were banned or challenged in over 20 states. This year, a controversy in Fayetteville, Arkansas, started with the removal of 3 sex ed books and recently morphed into a challenge against 70 books that allegedly contain vile and pernicious sexual premises. I unfortunately don't have a screen to enlarge this, but I hope you can see this is the website of the parent who has instigated this particular challenge. At the top it reads, "Welcome to teachclean.com. We are, parents protecting the minds of children." Anybody who wants to get the URL, see me later. The website goes on to list 70 books, and it has this interesting disclaimer. The pictures contained in the following links are considered to be pornographic and should not be viewed by anyone under 18 years old. And then it has, in very large type, link to shocking pictures. The website says, Fayetteville School Library has the following: 502 books listed under sex, but only 152 on drugs and 93 on smoking. I guess we better punch up the drugs and smoking part. 66 books on sex instruction, 53 books listed under homosexuality, 23 books on lesbians, 3 books listed under abstinence or sexual abstinence, 25 listed under homosexuality fiction, 11 listed under lesbian fiction, 16 books listed under rape fiction, 9 books listed under incest fiction, and my personal favorite, 209 books listed under witches fiction. And then it ends, for those who don't already know, now you know what diversity means, the promotion of the homosexual agenda. Books on the list include Forever by Judy Blume, Annie on My Mind, GLBTQ, The Survival Guide for Gay and Questioning Teens, Beloved, 100 Years of Solitude, Ragtime, Fallen Angels, and Bless Me, Ultima. This is how we spend our free time. Two of the authors on the American Library Association's list of the most challenged authors of 2004 have joined us today. We have Phyllis Reynolds Naylor, number one on the list. Judy Blume, author of Blubber, Forever, and Dini, among many others, is number three. We have Walter Dean Myers, whose book Fallen Angels is one of the ALA's most censored books of 2004, having been challenged repeatedly for racism, offensive language, and violence. Walter, take a bow. I wouldn't want our other panelists to feel slighted. New names are added every day, and every author on this panel has been targeted by the censors somewhere, sometimes, often many times. But I want to move quickly to the main event, letting you hear the authors read from their own censored works so you can decide for yourself what it is about their writing that makes them targets of attack. But first, I'm faced with the challenge of introductions. It would take an entire program to tell you in even minor detail about the accomplishments of the panelists, most of whom need no introduction. There are brief biographies in your program, and I hope you'll read those, but even that only gives you an inkling of their accomplishments and the recognition they have received for their writings. However, I can't give up the floor without sharing a few anecdotes and comments. My favorite Judy Blume censorship from this year involves a sixth grader in California who was suspended from school and charged with sexual harassment because she brought Forever to school to lend to a friend. True fact. Deborah Hartzig's novel Dollface is attacked because it deals with homosexuality, and in this respect, she's in the vanguard. According to the American Library Association, 3 of the 10 most challenged books of 2004 were cited for homosexual themes, which is the highest number in a decade. Robert Lipsy was challenged in Tennessee because his book, The Contender, sounds like pretty explicit stuff. You'll have to answer for that later. NCAC has on several occasions defended One Fat Summer, in one recent instance in a school district on Long Island, for those of you who think this stuff only happens in Kansas. Walter Dean Myers, as I mentioned, has the distinction of being in the top 10 regularly, as does Phyllis Reynolds Naylor. They must be doing something right, as evidenced by the fact that they are the recipients of numerous prizes and awards for their work. Peter Siss joins this esteemed company because, after a fairly blameless life, it seems, he took it into his head to write about Charles Darwin. It should come as no surprise that his book was excluded in a 2004 retrospective of his work at the Nickel Museum in Abilene, Texas. Rita Williams Garcia, welcome, is another acclaimed author of books for young adults. Her novel, Like Sisters on the Home Front, was removed from schools in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania because of language. Harrisburg isn't far from Dover, speaking of Darwin, where another interesting conversation about censorship is happening right now. So I hope you will join me in welcoming our authors. They will stand up one by one and read you whatever they want, because this is an anti-censorship program. And at the end of the program, we will have, I hope, some time for questions and answers. Anna, who's sitting in the front seat, will pass out cards and collect them, and I will read the questions to the panelists. Thank you very much. Please let us welcome our authors warmly.
Hi. Thank you for coming, and especially to these NYU students who I just met the other day. That is very, very nice of you to be here. I'm really glad to see you. They're all going to be teachers in a couple of years. I am going to read to you. Here's my problem. You know, I can't read without them, and I can't see you with them, so I'm just going to do what I can. I'm reading to you tonight from Dini. I like to read this scene. We're starting a new program in gym. Once a month, we're going to have a discussion group with Mrs. Rappaport. It sounds very interesting because Mrs. Rappaport asked us each to write down a question and drop it into a box on her desk. The question could be about anything, she said, especially anything we need to know about sex. She told us not to put our names on the paper. She doesn't want to know who's asking what. And it's a good thing, too, because I'd never have asked my question if I had to sign my name. I wrote, "Do normal people touch their bodies before they go to sleep? And is it all right to do that?" On Tuesday, when we walked into the gym, Mrs. Rappaport told us to sit in a circle so we could talk easily. The first questions she discussed were all about menstruation, but I already knew most everything from my booklet. After that, she said, "Okay, now I think we can move on to another subject. Here's an interesting question." She read it to us. "Do normal people touch their bodies before they go to sleep? And is it all right to do that?" I almost died. I glanced around. Then I smiled a little because some of the other girls did, and I hoped the expression on my face looked like I was trying to figure out who had asked such a thing. Mrs. Rappaport said, "Can anyone help us with an answer?" Susan Minton raised her hand. "Yes, Susan," Mrs. Rappaport said. "Well, I wasn't the one who wrote the question, but I've heard that boys who touch themselves too much can go blind or get very bad zits, or their body can even grow deformed." "Has anyone else heard that?" Mrs. Rappaport asked. 5 other girls raised their hands. Could it possibly be true, I wondered? And if it was true about boys, maybe it was about girls too. I felt my face get hot, and I had to go to the bathroom in the worst way, but I didn't move a muscle. I hoped nobody could tell what I was thinking. "Well," Mrs. Rappaport said, "I can see you've got a lot of misinformation. Does anyone here know the word for stimulating our genitals? Because that's what we're talking about, you know." It got very quiet in the gym. Nobody said anything for a long time. Then one girl spoke. "I think it's called masturbation." "That's right," Mrs. Rappaport told us. "And it's not a word you should be afraid of. Let's all say it." "Masturbation," we said together. "Okay," Mrs. Rappaport said. "Now that you've said it, let me try to explain. First of all, it's normal and harmless to masturbate." "You mean for boys," Susan Minton said. "No, I mean for anyone, male or female," Mrs. Rappaport told us. "The myths that some of you have heard aren't true. Masturbation can't make you insane or deformed or even give you acne." I
wanted to take a deep breath when she said that, but I didn't. I just gulped and looked at the floor. "Does everybody masturbate?" Barbara Curtis asked. "Not necessarily," Mrs. Rappaport said, "but it's very common for girls as well as boys, beginning with adolescence." "Any minute," I thought, "Mrs. Rappaport would ask us to raise our hands if we masturbate." And I wasn't sure I'd be able to tell the truth. I never knew there was a name for what I do. I just thought it was my own special good feeling. Now I wonder if all my friends do it too. But Mrs. Rappaport didn't ask us to tell her if we did or if we didn't masturbate. And I was so glad. It's a very private subject. I wouldn't want to talk about it in front of the class. She said the important thing to remember is that it's normal and that it can't hurt us. Nobody ever went crazy from masturbating, she said, but a lot of young people make themselves sick from worrying about it.
Thank you.
I'm reading from Hey Dollface, which was my first book. I wrote it when I was a junior in college, and it was published before I graduated, and I had no idea that it was going to offend anyone. I don't know if I would have had the nerve to write it, but fortunately, I did. How often do married people have sex, I wondered? Once a day? Once a week? Once a month? How often do they want to have sex? I wonder how often mom and dad do it, I thought. Do they wait till the middle of the night when I'm asleep so I won't hear the bed creaking? Do they talk at all when they do it? I sat there working up the courage to ask mom, and finally I said boldly, "Mom, how often do normal people have sex?" She looked ready to pass out. "I don't mean you or anything. I'm not asking about you. I just mean people in general, like people your age." "There's no such thing as normal, Val," she said, and got up to rearrange some things on the shelf. "Well, for goodness sakes, can't you give me a general answer? For all I know, it's once a year. If I can't ask my own mother, who can I ask?" I bellowed, following her into the living room. "I'm sorry, Val, you're right. I want you to ask me. I'm just not very good at discussing these things," she said weakly. "That's okay," I said gently, waiting for an answer. Boy, and I thought I'd be uncomfortable. Here I am, reassuring her. "So? Well, two or three times a week is normal." "Two or three times a week? That's average?" "Yes, I'd say twice a week is average." She jumped up and headed back toward the kitchen, and I followed her. "But Mom, is it more for people in their 20s, maybe?" "Yes, maybe it is. It depends on the people," she said. "Oh, I hate putting her through this," I thought. "But there it is. She's my mother, so I'm supposed to be able to ask her." "Well, what about old people?" "Not as much. Depends on the people. Some people have sex till they're very old, and some don't." "Well, how come old people do it less? Don't they want to?" "Well, most people as they get older don't want to as much as they did when they were younger." "Why?" "Oh, there's a hormone change." "Oh, I thought menopause and all that." "But some do?" "I expect so." "Well," I thought, "I wonder if it's that nobody wants to do it with a woman who's saggy and droopy. Will no one want me once I start looking older and have midriff bulge? I saw Grandma once in the shower, and her breasts hung so low, I couldn't believe it. It scared me at the time. Gosh, I hope I don't wind up like that, but I will. Shit, I wish I were flat," I thought, biting a fingernail absently. "It isn't because no one wants you when you're all saggy, is it?" Mom laughed a little. "Don't be silly. If two people love each other, that doesn't matter." She said it with such purity of conviction, it sounded almost beautiful. She sounds so innocent, I thought. She'd only said what I used to think every married person felt. But lately, every other movie and book was about people cheating on their husbands or wives or leaving them altogether, and maybe Mom was the rarity. I wonder if what she said is true, I thought. Maybe it is, but why are looks so important now? People say they don't matter, but you could bet your life they were all that mattered at things like school dances. I wish they didn't matter. They shouldn't. People shouldn't care so much. They should look farther than that. But if I was a knockout, I told myself grimly, I wouldn't be ungrateful. Maybe Mom's just lucky. I always had these visions about how one day I'd meet the person and we'd just love each other completely and forever and go to museums and concerts and love doing the same things, and that would be that. But maybe I won't meet the person. Maybe he doesn't even exist. No, he does exist someplace, but suppose he's a Russian and we never even get to meet. Mom, do looks really matter? No! Well, everyone should try to look their best, and that's about all you can do, but it's minor. No, Mom, I said thoughtfully. How can someone know you're terrific and wonderful before they talk to you? They can't, right? So they have to like your looks before they decide to say hello, right? Well, yes, said Mom, I suppose that's true. So looks do count? I pressed. Well, I told you, everyone should do the best they can with whatever God gave them. That sounded so simple, I began to wonder if she knew what people went through over their looks. Suppose God gave them acne or fat thighs. Mom, what about people who get nose jobs and ear jobs and God knows what else? Well, I think that's all ridiculous, she said, obviously relieved to be off the topic of sex. But if it makes someone feel better about themselves, it's worth it, I suppose. Well, didn't you once say that Shirley never would have gotten as far as she did in the fashion world if she didn't have her nose job? Shirley was my cousin. That's the fashion world, Val. That's just the way it is in fashion. It's not what counts. But it counts for her. In that way, maybe. But look at Shirley. She's not happy even with a nice nose. Maybe I should get a nose job. Mom looked at me as though I'd sprouted horns. Valerie, you're insane. You have a beautiful small nose. People pay thousands for noses like yours. Well, I said lamely, oh, what are you so worried about? You're a beautiful girl. I am not beautiful. You'd say that anyway, even if I were hideous. I suppose it could be worse, though, but I wish I were flat-chested. Oh, Val, shut up. You're crazy. Women are supposed to have bosoms. Oh, yeah, take a look at Vogue. Those women barely have bumps. Yes, and they eat nothing but lettuce and look like they're from concentration camps. They're supposed to be beautiful. They're ugly. They look like chickens. In Europe, if someone said, you've gained weight, it was a compliment. No kidding, I marveled. That was a new one. You can get pretty hung up with all these ads and the clothes they're selling and stuff, you know. No, I don't. Nobody wants a scarecrow, she said firmly. A couple of days later, Chloe and I were sitting in the library in between bookshelves looking for some history book she needed. The 311s who'd been loitering around the shelves whispering gave us a dirty look and slithered away, and Chloe thrust out her middle finger. I can't stand that class, she hissed. Hey, Chloe, those shoes Nelson was wearing with the stripes, what are they? Gucci, of course, and Cartier earrings, may they turn green. I snorted. Chloe, listen, what exactly is an orgasm? She dropped the book she was holding. She put her hand over my mouth and looked over her shoulder to make sure no one was listening. I pushed her hand off. Well, I know what it is from the dictionary, but I don't know what it is, I said. Well, how should I know? What does the dictionary say? Let's look it up. We hauled the dictionary over and looked. Here it is. One, the physical and emotional sensation experienced at the culmination of a sexual act as intercourse or masturbation, being a result of stimulation of the sexual organs and typically followed in the male by ejaculation. She looked at me. Well, what's two? She said. Two, an instance of experiencing this. Now, how the hell am I supposed to know what it's like from this definition? Chloe laughed. Your expression, you're so cute. Well, I guess you have to have one to know, maybe. Well, suppose I've had one and didn't know it. Nah, I asked my sister that once, and she said you can't miss it. Julie was nearly 20 and away at college. How would she know, I said. How do you think? So we have to wait and see then? Yes, dear, she said mockingly. Rats. I can't imagine why it's so important, I said, feeling disgruntled. Me neither. You know, I had sex education in the 5th grade and everything, but nobody ever bothers to tell you it's supposed to be fun. They just tell you it's for making babies, I grumbled. I used to think, well, my parents did it at least twice. Live and learn, doll face.
Hi, I'm Robert Lipside. I'm going to read three easy pieces from One Fat Summer. One of them is the one that keeps getting the book banned, and I don't remember writing it. And I, in fact, I think there are others that are worse that I'm going to read. I always hated summertime when people take off their clothes. In winter, you can hide yourself. Long coats, heavy jackets, thick sweaters. Nobody can tell how fat you really are. But in the summertime, they can see your thick legs and your wobbly backside and your big belly and your soft arms, and they laugh. I once had a daydream in which I was the invisible boy. Whenever I wanted to be invisible, I just drank a special potion I'd concocted in the chemistry lab. At first, I basically used my invisibility to solve crimes by eavesdropping on criminals while they were making their plans. There are problems in being invisible. You have to be very careful crossing streets since drivers can't see you, and you can only eat when nobody is around. If a sandwich suddenly jumps off a plate and disappears, you could give yourself away. Especially if you're on a criminal case. You know, crooks aren't all that dumb. Once they suspect there's an invisible person spying on them, they'll lock the doors, shut off the lights so you can't see them either, and keep feeling around the room until they catch you. About a year ago, in the daydream, I started using my invisibility to sneak into the girls' locker room at school. In the beginning, I just sort of skulked around the locker room, watching them undress. But then I got bolder and stood very close, and every so often, I might touch someone. In my daydream, they never screamed and they never ran away. I would get good warm feelings that started in my belly and flowed down. Sometimes, if I was alone in the house or in a locked bathroom, I would stroke myself until the warm feelings became a throbbing drumbeat that exploded. I told Joni about the invisible boy, which was a mistake. She has a very logical mind, and she asked me one question which spoiled everything. Does drinking the chemical make your clothes invisible too? Or do you have to walk around naked to be invisible? I told her that the chemical affected everything that you touch, so your clothes would be invisible too. But later, thinking it over, I realized that made no sense. I mean, what if you touched another person? Would she start to disappear too? So you'd have to be naked. And what would happen if you misjudged the amount of chemical that you drank? If you didn't drink enough to last until you got back to the lab? Or if you were delayed getting back to the lab by heavy traffic? You might suddenly become visible again, maybe in the middle of the street, maybe in the girls' locker room, and you'd be stark naked, and everybody would see you. I never had that daydream again. Now, the following is obscene, and I have to apologize for it. Peanut butter and ice cream are two of my favorite foods, but you've got to be careful eating them. They can hurt you. The only thing worse than a peanut butter strangle is an ice cream headache. A few times in my life, I've had both at the same time, and that is murder. They both come from eating too fast, and I am a fast eater. You've got to get it down quick if you are afraid of being caught in the act of eating. The peanut butter strangle hits you right away. The instant you take that first swallow, you feel a lump the size of a golf ball in your throat, and you know you've got it. I've tried to wash it down with cold milk or soda, even jam it down with bread crust like you do with a fish bone, but that only makes it worse. There's nothing to do but suffer. Tough it out like a man. You've got to keep swallowing. Feel that golf ball move slowly down your throat until it enters your chest. It's as big as a baseball by then. Shoving your heart out of the way, pressing against your breastbone, slowly working down the alimentary canal, leaving a path of agony and destruction. It's as big as a softball by the time it finally falls into your stomach and lies there, heavy and hard as a cannonball for hours until your stomach acids slowly dissolve it. An ice cream headache is sneakier. It takes at least a couple of minutes after you swallow a too big mouthful for the message to get up to your brain. Torture time. Then, blam, a shot between the eyes, sending you reeling against the refrigerator door. It spreads across your forehead, a dull ache boring through your skull. You can't think. You can barely focus your eyes. Well, I guess I can't get too excited about Willie Rumson coming after to kill me, because I've known real pain, self-inflicted. Thank you.
At 17, I joined the Army. It was full of romantic notions about war. I read a lot of the English poets from World War I. When I got into the Army, I found out that it was different. My younger brother joined the Army after me, and he was killed in Vietnam, first day in country. And this book was my reaction to that. It's been described as racist and obscene and violent. Insects chirped, moved through the night. There were shadows all around me, laughing, jerking, mocking. A sound. I raised my head slightly to hear better. Voices, Vietnamese voices. I brought my hand to the weapon. My finger played with the safety. Shadows ahead of me. They were coming out of the cemetery. They moved about, talking quietly, calm, sing-song rhythms. What were they talking about? The lousy child they got in their army, their families. Someone opened up, a scream. We were all firing. It was too dark to aim. I just fired in what I thought was the right direction. They began to answer fire. I could see faces over the lights from the muzzle blasts. I fired faster, trying to space my rounds in a sector. I heard a bullet whine past me and flinched, even though I knew it was already gone. A grenade went off, and then another. I kept firing. I didn't know where my rounds were going. Cease fire! Simpson's voice. Take cover. Lieutenant Carroll. A small pop and a flare went high into the air. A moment later, the entire area was lit up. There was nothing in front of us. I looked from side to side. Then I saw a body and another. Thin arms, not much difference in color than mine. A hand waving slowly in the night air, trying to push away the death already there. One body lay face down. There was a tremendous wound on the back. It's what a blast from an M16 can do. We kept shooting at the bodies, even though they were already dead. Get another flare up. Sergeant Simpson's voice cracked as he spoke. Bruna sent another flare into the sky as the rest of us searched the area with our eyes, not moving from the spot we were in. What the fuck happened? Monaco came through the trees. They passed by you? No, here. Pee-wee called us over and we went. He had found one of them lying a few feet from the entrance to a tunnel. The tunnel was near the corner of the cemetery, covered by a low, sprawling bush. Sergeant Simpson took a grenade, pulled the pin, and threw it into the opening as hard as he could. We stepped back, and a moment later, the grenade went off. Okay, let's hit it. We were starting off, Backing out of the village toward the pickup truck, I felt sick. My stomach churned. I looked for Pee-wee and found him. There was nothing to read in his face. A pop, nothing more. A small pop, almost lost in the sounds of the jungle around us. We hit the dirt, the mud. We returned fire again. Someone sent up a flare that was defective. It burned for a second and then went out quickly. To my left, I heard someone crying out, not loudly. There was no panic, but a gentle cry of surprise. I turned just as the last of the light from the flare was dying. It was Lieutenant Carroll. The squad lit up the woods with fire. Sergeant Simpson barked into the radio. We started making our way toward the village. Johnson and Wallerick carried Lieutenant Carroll. Carried him. He was limp. His legs dragged behind him. God have mercy. God have mercy. I looked toward his face, but he was a silhouette, lost in the darkness of the moment. Pain. I thought my heart was stopping. I couldn't breathe. We went to the edge of the village, and somebody shot off another flare. Keep their heads down. Sergeant Simpson pointed toward the village. We didn't see anything more. The fire could have come from the village. Lieutenant Carroll, lying behind a wide tree, was still. No one in the squad spoke. We were afraid for Lieutenant Carroll. We were afraid for ourselves. And our only answer to the fear that called each of us by names was to fire blindly into the fearful darkness. It took the chopper another 5 minutes to get to us. What we hadn't done to the village, it did. It leveled the huts. There were Vietnamese, mostly women and old men, running for their lives. Few of them made it more than a few feet as the chopper's guns swept everything in their path. These were the people we had come to save, to pacify. Now it was ourselves that we were saving. God have mercy. The chopper came down and we handed up Lieutenant Carroll, a burnt offering. We didn't hand him up gently through the chopper doors. We pushed him as hard as we could. It was his life, but it was our lives as well. We all climbed on and the chopper tilted, jerked, and was off. The door gunner kept spraying the village as we moved off into the night. A medic on the chopper looked for Lieutenant Carroll's wound, but couldn't find it. Bars of light passed through us. There were eyes, the outlines of helmets. There was Lieutenant Carroll unconscious. Anybody see where he was hit? The medic was already putting in the IV. We hadn't seen. There weren't any signs of blood. Maybe he just passed out, Monaco said. The medic didn't answer. We didn't land at the base. We went on to Chulao. The whole squad made the trip. We got there in what seemed a short time. An ambulance was waiting for us. They took Lieutenant Carroll, and the rest of us went off to one side and sat outside a building. I was trembling, and I couldn't stop. Pee-wee put his hand on mine and tried to calm it. I took deep breaths. A major came by, saw us sitting on the ground, and came over to us. What are you men doing here? I don't know, sir. I heard Monica say, what unit you with? Nobody answered. He looked at us and then said something about either him being in charge or maybe he asked who was in charge. I don't know. Sergeant Simpson got to his feet and talked to him, and then we were all headed over to a low building. It was a mess hall. The two cooks sitting listening to the radio got coffee for us. One of the medics who had been on the chopper came over. And we asked him how Lieutenant Carroll was doing. He said he didn't know, only that he was over in building A3. We finished the coffee and went over to see him. He got hit under the arm, a hawk-faced doctor was saying. That's why the medics couldn't find the wound, almost in the armpit. It wouldn't have done any good if they had found it, though. Monaco knew the prayer. Lord, let us feel pity for Lieutenant Carroll and sorrow for ourselves and all the angel warriors that fall. Let us fear death, but let it not live within us. Protect us, O Lord, and be merciful unto us. Amen. The book is banned because of the language And because of the allusions to race and to the violence. And I pledge that if I ever write about war again, I will make it as obscene as war is and as racist as it can be at times and as violent. Thank you.
I hope I can get through this, but I have laryngitis. If you can put up with this, I can. Can you hear me back there? I'm writing a series about a girl named Alice. It begins when she's 8 years old, and it's going to end when she's 60. And I have eight more books to go. And this scene takes place when she's just started fifth grade, and she's on a sleepover. When we got to her house on Friday night, her mother was friendly and cheerful and had a huge bowl of popcorn waiting for us in Rosalind's room. We watched a video and painted our toenails raspberry red. Then we left our sleeping bags on the floor and crowded onto Rosalind's bed. Megan wanted to tell ghost stories, but Rosalind asked if we wanted to see a private book. Private sounded more interesting than ghost, and we all said yes. It was a thin booklet with a paper cover, and on the front it said, "A Girl Grows Up." It wasn't easy for the five of us to look at the book all at the same time, so Rosalind said, "You want to take turns? Each one of us can read a page aloud. This book is about everything." Jody nodded eagerly, so Rosalind said, "I'll read the first page and you read the second." And she began, "Congratulations, you and your body are about to change in new and wonderful ways." It didn't take long for us to realize that it was talking about menstrual periods, and since none of the rest of us had a book called A Girl Grows Up, we wanted to hear every word. When it was Jody's turn to read, she put the book flat on the bed so we could see the drawing that went with the page, showing what the inside of a girl looks like with all her parts included. "It looks like a pear sliced open," said Megan, fascinated. It pointed out things like ovaries and fallopian tubes, the uterus, the bladder, and the vagina. Jody read how the ovaries release an egg once a month, no bigger than a teeny tiny dot. "The egg travels down one of the fallopian tubes to the uterus," Jody read. "If there is sperm to fertilize it, the egg attaches itself to the inner lining of the uterus and will grow into a baby. If fertilization does not take place, the soft, bloody lining of the uterus slides out the vagina once a month." "What's the vagina?" asked Megan. "The opening between your legs," said Rosalind. "Oh." Megan looked confused. "I thought that's where you pee," she said, then giggled and pulled the covers over her head. We all laughed and poked at her through the blanket. "There are two places," I said, because I knew that much. "One is the vagina, and the other is where the pee comes out." Now Rosalind poked me. "Three places, one where you poop," she said. And this time we all shrieked and stuck our heads under the blanket. And then Megan asked the question that all of us were wondering about. "When there is sperm inside you to make a baby, how does it get in there?" For a minute, nobody said anything. We just looked embarrassed because we had some idea of what happens between a man and a woman, but none of us knew exactly. "I think the father squirts it up there," I said finally, which was about all I knew about sex. "How?" asked Jody, joking, "with a spray bottle?" We all howled then so hard that we rolled off the bed laughing. When we climbed back on again, Rosalind said, "I think he puts it up there with his penis." Megan clapped one hand over Rosalind's mouth as though she'd said a bad word, and then Don reached up and turned off the light. It was easier talking in the dark. "He does not," said Megan. "My folks would never do that." "How then?" I asked. "The woman goes to the doctor, that's how," said Megan. The doctor puts his penis in her? I asked. No, Megan cried, and we all shrieked again. It's like Alice said, Rosam explained. The father puts his penis inside the mother. Dogs do it, cats do it, elephants do it. Well, people don't. It's gross, said Megan. We lay there in the dark thinking. Let's ask somebody, said Jody. Who's going to ask, said Don. Alice, said Rosalind. Alice will find out the answer and tell us Monday at recess. Why me? I protested. Well, I already asked my mom for a girl grows up, so it's somebody else's turn, said Rosalind. My mom doesn't even know about stuff like this, said Megan. Of course she does. She has children, said Don. I wouldn't ask my mom, though. I'd be too embarrassed. If I ask mine, she'd say, why do you want to know, asked Jody. Said Jody. They all looked at me again. I swallowed. Okay. Monday at recess, I said. That gave me exactly 2 days to find out. Rosin turned on the TV again, and we all pretended we were watching a video, but we weren't. I could see Rosalind looking at me on one side and Jody looking at me on the other, and this got us giggling again. I'll bet it's messy, said Jody. Maybe they do it in the bathtub, said Dawn. We giggled some more. Maybe they do it over the toilet, said Rosalind, and this time we laughed out loud. Later, after the other girls had gone to sleep, I lay there thinking about sperms and eggs and Mr. Dooley's baby back in fourth grade. If Rosalind was right, that meant that Mr. and Mrs. Dooley did it, that my own mother and father had done it, doctors did it, and dentists and teachers and lawyers and even George Washington and Abraham Lincoln. Everybody who had ever lived had got to this earth in the very same way. It was sort of a miracle. I didn't think it was gross at all. Excuse me. By the time I got home Saturday from the sleepover, Dad had already left for work, and Lester was getting on his bike to ride to his part-time job. Didn't seem like a good time to ask about sperms and eggs, so I just said, see ya, and he drove off down the driveway. That night, Lester browned the hamburger for chili. I cut up the green peppers and onions, and Dad made some cornbread. When we sat down to eat, I remembered what I was supposed to ask, but I didn't want Dad and Lester to think I didn't know anything. I know all about sex, I began. I saw Lester roll his eyes. Dad looked up. What? I mean, you don't have to start at the beginning, I said. You don't have to tell me everything. That's good, said Lester, because I sort of wanted to talk about basketball. Yeah. I ignored him. I know that it takes a man and a woman to make a baby, but I don't know exactly how the man gets his sperm inside the woman, I said. With a glue gun, said Lester, and took a bite of cornbread. Les, said Dad, and then he cleared his throat. I don't know why it is that I can't get a simple answer to a simple question instead of a lot of throat clearing in the whole history of the human race. When a man and woman want to start a family, Dad began. Please don't start with buying a house, I said. Yeah, Dad, cut to the chase, said Lester. So Dad speeded up. People who love each other want to get their bodies as close together as possible, and when that happens, the man puts his penis inside the woman's vagina. And out comes the sperm, I ask. Something like that, said Dad. Like pee, I ask. Not that much, said Dad. For crying out loud, I'm eating, Lester complained. Sounds messy to me, I said. I thought about it a minute. Where do they do it? In the bathtub? Over the toilet? Lester bolted back in his chair. I don't believe this, he said. Then he hunched over his plate again. They do it out in the backyard, Al, and hose themselves down afterwards. Lester, Dad said, she's asking some basic questions here. They do it in bed, Alice. People make love in bed. Oh, I said, all over the sheets? It's not as messy as you think, Dad said, and what mess there is doesn't matter. Oh, I said again. I wondered if there was anything else the girls wanted me to ask. How long does it take, I asked. Just a few minutes or as long as a couple wants it to last, Dad said. Now about those Boston Celtics, Lester began, and he and Dad talked basketball. As soon as the bell rang for recess on Monday, Jody and Don and Megan and Rosalind followed me around the school and back to the teacher's entrance, where we huddled together on the steps. Did you find out? Asked Jody. I nodded and told them everything Dad had told me. I can't believe it, said Megan, thinking, I guess, of her parents. Then that's how they got my sister. And you, I said. We sat in hushed silence. Let's don't tell anyone else, said Dawn. Let's be the only girls in fifth grade who know. I just can't believe it, Megan said again. It's how everybody gets born, Megan, I told her. Mrs. Swick and Mr. Dooley, too. The principal, the president. Moses, even, said Jody. But not the Pope, said Megan. Even the Pope, I told her.
I'm Peter Cease, and I wanted to read a long article from New Yorker about evolution, but since everybody's reading so well, I don't think I want to put you through this, because I didn't go to school in this country. I grew up in what was called behind Iron Curtain, and I grew up with censorship, really. I mean, I was born into society when censorship was part of everything. We knew there are books which are not supposed to be read, things which are not supposed to be talked about, mostly politics, but sex too. And we all had little red scarves, and we marched to the same music, 1st of May, November. And I studied in the art school, and my first ever professional experience as an artist was that I was commissioned to the record cover. There was a thing called LP Records, which don't exist anymore. And I did the record cover for the record called Airport, and it was like little old-fashioned airport with the windsock blowing in the wind. And I was about 20 years old, and I brought it into the record company, and they said, did you check which side is the wind supposed to blow from? And I thought it was a joke, but it was a political issue, because the wind can blow from left to right or right to left, and in the Italian country that can have all kinds of meanings, especially because of the location of Soviet Union. So I spent 1 hour waiting for the phone call from, they placed the phone calls with Ministry of Interior and Ministry of Information, and then after 1 hour they said, you are lucky, your wind is blowing in the right direction. Which was lucky, because if I was left-handed, I would have to probably overdo it. So I thought, that's not my future to get into all this. And I started to do animation. And my first ever professional animated film, which was 10 minutes long, was called The Island for 6,000 Alarm Clocks. And it was a fairy tale about people who hit alarm clocks every morning when they wake up. And the alarm clocks get upset, and they walk away from people, and they go to the island where they can buzz and ring as much as they please. But that was giving people the idea, if they don't like something, they can walk away from it and go somewhere else where they can ring and buzz as they please, so the film wasn't ever shown in the public. So when I got a chance to make film in Los Angeles for the Olympic Games in 1984, I wasn't thinking about staying forever, but definitely I thought, now I'm in the country where there is no censorship. And then, because of all the circumstances, and I guess I wasn't paying enough attention, I got into books, and I always felt I want to celebrate people who wouldn't be marching with little red scarves to the same music, but about the people who think independently and who are free thinkers, and that's sort of motivation for what I'm doing. And I'm glad I did a book on Charles Darwin, because he was one of these heroes like Galileo or Jan Welzel and Einstein, that if I wouldn't have done that book, I wouldn't know that 2/3 of Americans don't believe in evolution, and I probably wouldn't have a chance to meet all these wonderful people here. So I thought, since I can't read, I would just read a very short sentence from writings of Charles Darwin, which I think should be the answer to all these people who don't want to discuss anything. And forgive my pronunciation. As far as I can judge, I'm not apt to follow blindly the lead of other men. I have steadily endeavored to keep my mind free so as to give up any hypothesis, however much beloved, and I cannot resist forming one on every subject. as soon as facts are shown to be opposed to it. And this is all I wanted to say. Thank you very much.
Hello. I have to say that I was very surprised to hear that Like Sisters on the Home Front was banned for language. I don't think I have one four-letter word in that book, so I was very surprised it was for language and not for the abortion in the first chapter. We are evolving. I'm going to read to you from No Laughter Here, which is my most recent novel, and it's my first younger voiced novel. So, oh, I should tell you that this is a story about two girls, both 10 years old. Akila is African American and Victoria is African. And they've just had sex education class. I think I'll spare you that since we've been through sex ed. Victoria has run out of the classroom, and Akila has gone after her. Victoria wasn't in the library. She was sitting out by the hopscotches as she did during recess. "Here you are," I said, as if I had just discovered her. In reality, I stood and watched her for a little while before I came out into the schoolyard. "I went into the library looking for you." She didn't answer me, but I felt her willing me to sit next to her, so I did. We sat for a long time, 2 or 3 minutes. Then she turned to me and she said, "I don't look like that." I didn't understand what she meant, but I knew she'd explain. As I sat waiting, a happiness ran through me, like Christmas morning at 6 a.m. I was finally getting what I wanted. Today, Victoria would return to me from where she had been, looking at me directly and staring off, and not staring off, she said, "Akila, what I'm going to tell you is a secret." We were already practically breath to breath, but I managed to move in closer. "You cannot tell anyone." "Okay," I said. "Not okay," she said. "Okay isn't good enough. You must take a vow. Repeat after me. If I should tell, I will die." I was stunned. "Say it." She sounded like the real Victoria. I took her seriously. "If I should tell, I will die. I will not tell my mother. I will not tell my mother. Even if she beats me." "My mother wouldn't say it." "Even if she beats me." I laughed to myself. "Auntie Cass wouldn't hesitate to draw her belt, but my mother, she'd never ever hit me." "I will not tell a soul, dead or alive." I wanted to giggle when she said dead. She raised her eyebrows. I repeated after her, "Dead or alive." "Now show me your hands," she said. "I don't want you to cross your fingers." I placed my hands on my lap where she could see them. "Say, I will not tell God, not even in my prayers." My mother would have said, "God already knows," but I didn't dare. I said, "I will not tell God, not even in my prayers, or I will die in Victoria's eyes, for she will no longer be my true friend." I repeated all of it. A few minutes of silence passed before she said, "They showed the picture of the baby girl in class." "Uh-huh. I don't look like that." I didn't know what she meant. A chubby white baby girl with her legs wide open, showing her privates. "Of course you don't look like her. I don't either." In fact, before Victoria left for Africa, we compared our soft, fuzzy hair growing down below. Mine was more visible than hers. "I don't have what girls have," she told me. I still didn't know what she meant. "They took it while I was sleeping." "Took it?" She made no sense. "My mother, my Auntie Omadara and Auntie Olafemi, my grandmother Iyapo, they took me to see Dr. Ajala. I thought for more shots or to look at my teeth. First, my mother inspected Dr. Ajala's knife, and then she told him to put me to sleep first. My auntie started yelling at my mother. They said things like, "Do you think we will fail to hold her down?" My grandmother said she could have done it at home without so much fuss. She had done many girls, but my mother was very strong. "We are modern," my mother said. Then she told the doctor and told everyone to be quiet. He could lose his license because it was illegal. Illegal? Illegal. When he said illegal, my mind imagined the worst. I thought, how could my mother make us do something so horrible the doctor could lose his license? I could not imagine what it was. I was not sick. I didn't need to see a doctor. But my aunties and grandmother wouldn't stop yelling at her and Dr. Ajala. My mother remained strong. She wouldn't give in to her sisters and her mother. She said things like I was not accustomed to hearing her say, "Don't ask me to repeat them." Oh, she read my mind well. Then the doctor put me to sleep. To sleep? While he operated. Operated? Now I sounded like Victoria had when she first returned, repeating and questioning. My mind raced with horror and curiosity, and yet I made no pictures for what she was telling me. It was as though the picture-taking part of my brain had shut down. When I woke up, I thought I was dead inside my body. I could see, but I couldn't move. Then the feeling came back to me slowly, not on the outside, but outside of my body, like I was a ghost. Visiting Grandmother Iapo's house, sound around me did not seem real. I heard music, but it seemed far away like echoes. I heard laughter and talking, but it didn't seem real. I still did not know what had happened to me. I did not remember coming back to grandmother's house. I called for my mother. She helped me to the bathroom. I could not barely stand. She had to hold me when I squatted. My ghost body fled and my real body returned. When the pee came out of me, I screamed. I was being burnt alive, but there was no flames creeping up my legs. For weeks and weeks, I stood in a pot of fire. Fire? I slowly began to feel, although I couldn't picture anything. Only knife took fire. She knew this, and she said, "Have you ever played Touch My Raisin?" I nodded. "And it felt good and tickly when you touched it?" Only to Victoria could I admit this. "Mm-hmm," I said. So good you didn't want to stop?" I nodded again. She pointed between her legs to what I call the private place, the Paths of Discovery class called genitals, and kids on the playground had nasty names for. She said, "When I was sleeping, they took my raisin." My belly flopped. I felt dizzy. I didn't expect to hear what she had told me. Mum said not to cry. She said all proper Nigerian girls have this done to stop the feeling. Stop the feeling? She said, the feeling that comes from touching your raisin. I still cry. "That's okay," Victoria whispered. When we returned home, you know, to Queens, I nodded. I locked myself in my room and got my mirror to squat over it and see. Akilah, after they took my raisin, they sewed my skin together to hide what they did. Thank you.
Well, these are some pretty hard acts to follow. I have some questions that have been handed up. If anybody has additional questions, wave a hand and Anna will give you a card. I'm going to read the questions and then open the floor for comments by our authors.
Hi.
What do you feel or think when you first learn your work has been censored? Somebody want to take this?
For me, it was shock, surprise, anger, hurt. It's changed over the years because it's not as unexpected, unfortunately, as it was when it happened. The 70s, when I wrote so many of these books, including Dini, the book I read from, the 70s were a very open and good time for writers and readers. And in 1980, everything changed with the political election, and it's grown. I mean, Joan can tell you, it just keeps growing. There's good news on the other end, I think, because some teachers are dealing with it in the classroom. You know, what is this First Amendment? What does it mean? And kids are beginning to take action. That's all good. Publishers who ran very scared in the 80s and into the 90s are less scared today, and that's because selling books is a business, and they've found out that they can sell books anyway, even if they're not used in the schools.
Anybody else want to answer that?
Well, I was proud because it put me in Judy Blume's league. But actually, in my experience, it's less heroic than it would seem. It's not Fahrenheit 451. It's some kind of pissed off mother who may have an agenda of some kind, who gets to the principal or superintendent, who is an ex-football coach, who has a second job that he wants to get to after 3 o'clock, does not want the bother. And ultimately, you win. Because the teachers have been, you know, teaching your book for 25 years, and they'll be damned if they're going to, you know, rewrite their curriculum. So I have kind of a somewhat cynical, you know, view of all of this, because very often, you know, it's as petty as that. What's really dangerous, and which you should really be talking to, is the fact that there are organized groups with real religious, ideological, and political agendas who are targeting not just us, but America in a very meaningful way.
I didn't find out that I was number one on the list until I went to my email one morning and saw about 9 or 10, congratulations, congratulations. And then I read them, and they were all saying, you made the list, you're the top of the list. And you know, a lot of books sell a lot more when it's banned, and it's really a ridiculous thing.
When I go to the juvenile detention halls and I talk to young people, what I realize is that these young people needed to engage life intellectually prior to encountering it on the streets. And I think that the books that we do will allow young people to engage these ideas intellectually. And so when they can think about them, the schools are a perfect place to discuss the ideas and to think about them, and even among their friends. So I think that when we're doing books which are, people are trying to protect the kids, or they have the agenda, their own agenda. They don't understand what's going on with these young people. And I think if they went to the juvenile detention centers, if they went to the prisons, where you see these young people, or you go to the schools in which half the kids are pregnant at 13 and 14 years old. You go to the many, many institutions where children are now badly damaged because they did not have the mentoring at home, I think they would change their minds. I hope they would change their minds.
I've not gotten a congratulations, you're on the list email, but what I do get is something something more common, that the books being returned, a class set, someone writing to say, gee, you know, we'd like to have you here. I tried to get this book approved for your visit, but our principal won't allow it, you know. So censorship comes in many forms. I just got an email yesterday, as a matter of fact, from a young lady who read No Laughter Here, and she said she had to get a form. Now she's 15 years old. She had to get a form filled out by her parent so she could read this book. I mean, these are all forms of censorship. When a young gay person or someone who thinks maybe they are gay wants to read a book that might talk about the experience, but the book is behind a glass case somewhere and you have to go and ask somebody for it. This is a way of blocking a person from the information. This is all censorship. So it's in a way, it's kind of good to have a list so you can see, oh, these are the books that are being targeted, and so we can be aware and we can rally for those books. But it's very pervasive in our culture, and it comes in so many different forms. And there's just simply so many different ways to block readers from books, and I think we have to all be aware of it.
I just wanted to mention, when this book came out, I was going down to Texas, and this one of the people from there said, you're lucky I'm a proof of evolution, but they will cut you up down there. And so I was going with a little bit of fear, but I was hoping for some sort of discussion. And it was a strange week I spent down there, because everybody was sort of, instead of having discussion, was avoiding the subject and would just say, okay, well, we don't approve of this book, so no. And then in the end, they said, well, you probably thought that's going to be some conflict, but you're lucky because all the men are involved with the high school football, so they left you alone. So it was no discussion. I didn't get beaten up, but it just didn't lead to anything. I think the discussion wouldn't hurt.
You want to add to that very quickly? I've published more than 80 books in my life, and the only book I've ever written that was banned was my first book, which is the one I was reading to you from, and I was 21, and I was really shocked, and ultimately thrilled, and because the book is about a friendship between two 15-year-old girls who love each other and may or may not be gay, and I thought it was a love story that I'd written, and I was just so appalled that anybody would think that there was anything untoward about it. Just anyway, they hate me in Texas, which is really, I'm so proud.
All right, here's a good question for our panel. My first book, a young adult novel, has been challenged in several states. Now as I write my next book, I can feel the chill of self-censorship. What advice or words of encouragement would you offer?
Wherever you are, don't give in to that censor on your shoulder, because that's the worst thing that can happen. You've got to kick it off. You've got to kick it off, and you have to go down deep inside where the best books come from, and not give in to the fear, because that's exactly what the censors want you to do. They want to so frighten you that you won't write the most honest books for kids. So you gotta write it.
Others? Okay. Yes, ma'am. In your opinion, what are the consequences of withholding controversial, for lack of a better word, literature from kids who are curious? in reading such literature, yet have parents, teachers, or community leaders who forbid such literature because it's radical. Somebody want to take that? Consequences for children of withholding information from them, withholding books?
Again, you know, when I talk to kids who are in difficulty, very often I was surprised to find that they were surprised to be in a juvenile detention center. I said, "Why are you surprised? You committed a crime, or you did something that was wrong." But they sort of slid into the behavior that got them there. You know, we as a society give out mixed messages. We give out mixed messages. We say that violence is good. We say that selling drugs is okay, is acceptable. And we say that on television and what have you. I think that in books that people like this are writing is the only place where these ideas are actually engaged as ideas. And when you don't engage them, young people at 12, 13, 14, and 15 years old, where do they get their information? Now, if they're getting it from the streets, it's bad news. It's bad news. And if they're getting it from someone who says that it doesn't exist, this part of the world doesn't exist, it's just stupid.
I think we get them to read by having Judy Blume write books.
No. That's all nice and all of that, but the truth is that even kids who are readers up to 12, I mean, that this is something that we know. To get them to keep reading, even some of those kids, I've corresponded with a lot of kids in trouble. They were readers until they were 12, and then nothing. So it's tough. It's tough.
I like Walter, I do go out to a lot of schools. What I hear wherever I go is, "I can't believe you wrote that." You know, "I can't believe that you told the truth. I can't believe you said that in this character's voice. Is that your experience?" "No, I had a very different experience." "Really? Wow." What we're seeing from young people is a feeling that if you read our books, we will tell you lies, or we will shade it in a certain way. They can't believe that we will actually blow the lid off of something and say it in a way that it's meaningful to them. When they hear that, wow, you know, they perk up, they listen. They want to know, are there any more books like this? Then I can start talking about all of the books out there that they don't know are there. That's the thing. The books are there. They're wonderful books, wonderful authors out there. They're not being read because the kids don't know.
So, you know, also, you know, what we're trying to do is to get more parents to read with children, and some of the organizations I'm involved with now, organizations like 100 Black Men, which has chapters across the country, we're trying to get adults to read books with kids and to use books in the mentoring process. But I think, I agree with you, and over the last year, I've been approaching organizations and trying, like the Lynx and Jackson Jills and people like that, and trying to get adults to read the books themselves, and then if they think the book is something they can use, to read them with kids. I mean, that's how I got my kids to read.
I just want to make a comment that one of the things we've observed, I think, is that the books that are censored get censored because the kids want to read them. That's how they come to the attention of the people who want to censor them. So it is this content that young people are hungry for, and that they don't necessarily find in everything that is offered them. And the other point that I would make just from our conversations with teachers, and we have a lot of, we deal with a lot of teachers, as you can imagine. So teachers always say that books are the safe way to learn about life. That if you don't learn about the difficult things in life through books, and you have to learn it for real in the real world, you're much worse off. So teaching young people about some of these issues in the safe context of a classroom is, in their view, a much better way to do it. Let me move on with the audience's questions. Here's a good one. Is there an interesting book or series like the ones we've heard tonight for low-level readers? I teach fifth graders who could handle the topics but are low-level readers. Anybody have any suggestions for this person?
Unfortunately, not for that young in age group. My experience has always been to work with teenagers who are reading on the second grade level, mothers who can barely read their names. I know of a series I've contributed for Scholastic. It's Ono Books, and they have about three different levels of books for young people, and the idea is to give them language and experiences outside of their own, but also mirroring their own, to give them kind of a diversity of literary experiences, but in language that A, they can grasp and they can build on. Does anybody know of any? It's Ono Books from Scholastic. But I don't know of any geared for the much younger.
Anybody have suggestions? Yeah, please.
I'm Margaret Tice, coordinator of children's services at the library. I would recommend audio versions of the book because many of our authors' books are for good readers or readers at a fifth grade reading level, but if kids aren't reading at that level, they can still listen to the story. And I would really highly recommend the audio versions. And Patrol is an example for younger children.
Right.
Thank you. Here are two similar questions. We've touched on this a little bit, but maybe people would like to amplify on this. Has censorship or fear of having your books banned affected your creative process as a writer? And do you ever censor yourself? These are related questions, I think. Maybe people would like to address them together. Do I have takers?
I was blessed enough to come into writing for young people with ignorance. I had no idea what the rules of the road were, so it just didn't occur to me to follow any. Even after having gone through the editing and having been reviewed, I thought and thought, gee, I better do something that's going to sell some books that will make it into more schools and that kind of thing. I really, truly thought about the character that would be embraced by most readers in most schools and all of that, and I just kept writing the characters that I knew and that I love. So my publisher would love to see me write a little bit more of a universal themed book as opposed to, say, female genital mutilation and that kind of thing, abortions in the first chapter. But I think I just write what I write, and you know, that's what I bring. I mean, there are hundreds, if not thousands, of writers out there. Why do I have to be one of them? I should be one of me.
Yeah, I'm doing a book on life during the time of Cold War, and same thing. Nobody knows what Berlin Wall was anymore, and you know, so I don't know if I will ever finish it. But dealing with that subject too. And I would just like to say it's true what Judy Blume said, that the self-censorship, since I grew up with it, is just the most awful thing, because that's why I'm so proud that my children seem to be free and not sort of hindered by that as we were. It's just awful, because you sort of can't get rid of it. Or as the man who was, when I was selected for the, well, I wasn't in the end for the jury duty, he said, "You are damaged forever."
Anybody else? Have you ever censored yourself?
Never. Not in my writing. In my life, I have. But what's the point in writing a book or writing anything, especially if it's for children, if you're going to not tell the truth? I never, not in a million years.
But I can tell you stories about, I'll just tell you one, about an experience that I had when I wrote Here's to You, Rachel Robinson. And it's a book about a family and a 15-year-old brother who's a disruptive child within this family, and he loves playing that role. And he's very, he's intellectual, and he doesn't need to use four-letter words. And once in this entire book, he raises a glass of grape juice to his sister Rachel, and he says, "Here's to you, Rachel Robinson. Here's to our whole fucking family." Once in this book. And my editor said to me, "It's your book, Judy. And if you choose to use that word, fine. But I do think you should know that you will lose all," and I love this editor, "you will lose all book club sales. And you might want to think about that. Because if you say, what's that other word? Frigging. If you say frigging, a word that I never use because I use fucking. If you say, 'Here's to my whole frigging family,' you won't lose those sales," which I found unbelievable. Don't people know what that is? Or effing family. And I said, "Okay, I'll think about it." And I talked to my grown son about it. And he said, "You're Judy Blume. You're supposed to be honest. People count on you to be honest. How could you even think about not using that word that you know that Charles would use?" And of course, I knew that that was, it was the word, it was the only word that Charles would use. And so I used it, and it was published, and there were no sales to book clubs. And I got a million letters from people, and I finally, you know, I wrote a letter explaining language when you're writing and how you hear it in your head. You hear what this character says. This isn't saying that the reader should use this language. It's not promoting language. It's telling the truth. And I don't know.
Yeah, like, what really strikes me as odd in the Army, this is a book about war, and they say you shouldn't use language, but what happens when you go into the Army, they have to change you from a 17 or 18 or 19-year-old who should not hit a stranger to a person who's capable of killing people that are strangers, and you have to be capable of killing people that you don't know, and that you may not even have a particular reason to kill. But this is what you do as a soldier, and this is what you do in the Army. And one of the ways they make that conversion is through, they do two things. They demonize the enemy, and you find yourself calling people names like gooks and ragheads, and I have a son who's a chaplain in the Air Force at this point. He tells me the names. And then the other way is by forcing you to use language in a different way. And so, you know, I didn't curse in the Army. My first went into the Army, and my first 3 days in the Army, I was cursed up one side of my, and down the other side. And by the time I had been in the Army 5 weeks, every single thing that I touched had the prefix of fucking. You know, this fucking potatoes and this fucking tent and this fucking army and this fucking, you know, and they change you. They change you. And that is a use, a very careful use of language. And when my son went into the Air Force, he said, he was a very nice kid. He's a minister now, a chaplain now. He's always been sort of had a religious bent. He says, a little lady officer, you know, cursed him until he cried. You know, but this is part of the military experience.
And if you don't write it, I'm going to finish this for you. If you don't write this honestly and truthfully, then what is the point?
What's the point?
I mean, what is the point?
Here we have a question, which is the flip side. Is there an upside to having one of your books banned, i.e., the book becomes more well known and attracts attention?
Yes. We don't have to belabor it. Yes.
Yes.
Yeah. Yes, it does, I think.
Some dissent. Dissent?
Anybody want to comment further on this? And I must say that from dealing with authors, not all of whom are as widely acclaimed as these, we get calls of people in serious pain wondering why their book has been banned, what's so wrong. It's, you know, a book is a very important part of a person's mind and soul, and people feel rejected. So I think that if you are fortunate enough to have, you know, a big collection of books out there, and sometimes censorship calls more attention to them, and you're very secure in your career, it's one thing. If you don't, I think people feel extremely vulnerable. At least that's the experience that we have had working with authors.
Okay.
This is to Ms. Naylor. Has the popularity of Alice in terms of her becoming a role model for so many girls changed the way that you write?
No, it hasn't, but it's changed the way I answer letters of protest. I used to be very, very careful about it, and I'm getting angrier. This book, particularly, Lovingly Alice, that I read to you, and this part that I read to you, provoked a letter from a mother that began, "How dare you?" And she said, "I wanted to sit down with my daughter when she was 11 years old with a Bible and tell her how sex was God's plan for the universe. Instead, she got to this first, and that line about the penis enters the vagina," she said, "is forever burned on her mind." And I think before I would have written a two-page letter and talked about all kinds of things, and I just said, if your daughter is of average intelligence and she's 10 years old, she has seen a pregnant woman and wondered how that baby got in there. And if she hasn't felt comfortable enough to come to you and ask, then I really pity your relationship. And yeah. I know. But of course, she wrote back, and we have a wonderful relationship, and on and on and on. But it's gotten to the point where I go right to the jugular sometimes. And it's changed that way. Very good. What were you waiting for, she says.
Okay, I don't know whether our panelists will feel comfortable responding to this, but I'll ask them anyway. How do you feel about the fact that we were all subjected to illegal, at least according to our Bill of Rights, searches upon entering this library to hear this program on free speech? Anybody want to take this? Or is this maybe this is just food for thought and for the next election and when you write to your member of Congress about the Patriot Act and so on?
Yeah, these are difficult times. We're learning as we go along. You know, I mean, and we're learning. I'm going to London tomorrow, and I know I'm going to be searched before I get on that plane, and I'm going to have all kinds of things checked before I get on that plane. And I think we're learning. I think we're learning to strike a balance between the realities of life and the various realities of life. And I think that this is what we have to do. And I think that as long as we are intellectually facing the issues, as not just following them sheepishly, we'll be okay.
I just wanted to tell you about a very strange experience I had last weekend. I was speaking at the National Book Festival on the Mall, and during the signing sessions, all of the people in lines, children too, were told that if they wanted their picture with the author, they could not get behind her or him. Security. It was the first time I've ever come across that they were afraid that authors would be hurt somehow if somebody stepped behind you. That's scary.
They weren't afraid for me.
I have a question about the book that Judy Blume and Walter Dean Myers read from. Judy Blume's was Dini, right? And Walter's was Fallen Angels.
Right.
And somebody wants to know, Judy, if you're going to write another novel for teenagers.
I don't know.
Okay.
Publishers seem to be embracing the controversial teenage novel right now instead of being afraid of it. And so I've been reading a lot of very good books that come to me in manuscript form. And maybe I don't have to write any more books for teenagers. I don't know. I have to write what I have to write. Right now I'm writing for very young children, so... Who knows? Sometimes I say I'm never going to write anything again, and I mean it when I say it. And I say it a lot.
Hang on, because this one's for you too, Judy. Have you ever been physically attacked for your writings?
Is somebody out there got a plan? I've never been physically attacked. I've been told many times I will burn in hell, and you know, lots of letters like that. There was a time when I was scared coming out in public, but not anymore.
Someone wanted to know the source of my comments about the 100 greatest books of the 20th century. That was the Modern Library Association list, and their editors compiled that list. It was a list of fictional books, and a third had been banned, approximately a third had been banned, and more than that have been banned and challenged. So that one's from me. Okay, do you find it frightening that television, movies, and magazines are encouraged to address controversial topics and often provide misinformation? And why do you think literature is subject to such a different standard of scrutiny?
Well, I think that's why we're under attack here, because we're much more vulnerable than those much larger, more powerful media organizations. I'd like to speak for the censors, if I might, for just a moment. I think it's really important that we don't get too locked into this easier New York, LA sensibility of, because, you know, we are really cool and smart. But really, you know, I go out there a lot, and there are people who really feel under siege, who really feel that television and the movies and rap and all these things out there are taking control of their kids' minds. You know, they've got, each of them have two jobs, and they're very busy. And maybe one of the reasons that they didn't get to, you know, to talk about wet dreams before the kid got to get it properly from you is because they, you know, get home late, and they're not, you know, they don't have nannies and all of the good things that we have here. So, I mean, I think one of the things we have to do is kind of find some way to separate, even in our thinking, you know, some of those people who really need our help from, you know, the really vile, orchestrated organizations with these political and religious and ideological agendas. I mean, I think that's, and the idea of, you know, when you're reaching out to strike out, it's a lot easier to attack some little book in your kid's library than it is, you know, to go after NBC or Desperate Housewives or you know, 50 Cent or whoever it is, you know, that happens to be making you really crazy.
Somebody wants to know whether, as a result of this event, anybody will stop writing books or change their format.
Too old?
Too old to change now.
This is a positive event. Yeah. This is a celebration, in a way.
Okay, but you're all pretty true blue, do what you do. Okay. I'm not sure I entirely understand the question, but maybe the person who wrote it can help us out if there's other misunderstanding. Do you think the mayor was using Flushing, in quotes, as a pun for free speech, i.e., Flushing words one cannot relate to? I write poetry unpublished. Most people are awkward when I tell or show them.
I think that actually you all were somewhere else when we were talking, but we did talk about the fact that the mayor did declare a free speech zone. If you remember last year when the mm-hmm. RNC was in town, mm-hmm. they declared Flushing, Queens, to be the designated RNC, designated free speech zone.
Right.
And I have no idea what the mayor was thinking, honestly.
He was thinking he didn't want problems on 34th
he
Street.
He didn't want any of us here. I mean, we didn't want to have real free speech. I mean, that's for sure. Do you have anything to say?
I mean, and part of the reason that we did this, wanted to do this event tonight and also the installation outside is really to highlight the issue of what is a free speech zone and just the way that the term has kind of come into our culture. And in fact, as we talked about earlier, that a free speech zone really isn't about free speech. It's about not having free speech and allowing people to speak as far away from the event that they really want to voice their opinions at.
The issue of free speech zones has come up in the courts, but that's a subject for another panel. One more question. Okay. I'm sorry for those whose questions I've missed, but I'll ask the last one. What are the panelists' thoughts on the recent controversy surrounding the Rainbow Party? Do people need any clarification? Then whoever wrote the question, can you clarify?
I think that sometimes, well, back in the 70s, when publishing was quite a bit different. There are people who publish very interesting stuff, and there are people, we're not all saints. I think we do we can be exploitative. We can try to jack up sales with something shocking, and I think that happens. Happened back in the 70s. It also happens now. I think that the people who are damn good writers, and they put out damn good books, and then there are people who will try to hook into the latest scandal, and I think that some writers are doing that even today. We're not all angels. I'm personally an angel, but.
For those of you who don't know, the Rainbow Party, that's a book about a group of kids. They've got this game, you know, the girls wear the lipstick, the boys supply the penis, and then you, exactly. Okay. Oh, my God. You know, this kind of, this goes along with, should a book exist? I mean, I think everything has to do with the author's motives, and I think Walter was hitting it on the head when he was talking about, you know, are you just publishing something because you think it's the latest trend and you're going to make some money and everybody's going to talk? You know, what value is this book? And when I say value, I don't mean, you know, how does it serve the greater good? I mean, is there a literary value to this book? Is it anything other than, oh, look here, kids, you know, here's something that we can go and get your, we're going to go and get your money, and I'm going to make a name for myself. You know, it's, and I'm going to speak to that simply because it's one of the things that my poor publisher is concerned that I take on controversial topics, and that my name is not associated with controversy, but with story quality. And I think this is kind of the concern here. But I feel this very strongly that it has everything to do with the reader's right and ability to sit down, read something, and accept it, reject it, talk it up, talk it down. This is what we're trying to develop up here. I don't want anybody to take it upon themselves to tell my children what they can and cannot read, because no one is qualified to do that. But hopefully I'm raising them so that they can do that. And then if they're very young and they need my help to discern that, trust me, I will step in there. But they're like, they're off to college and everything, so I'm not concerned about that. But what I'm saying is that either we are raising a literate, critical thinking society where you can pick up a book and say, oh, this is trash, or oh, that was funny, but it, you know, it has nothing to do with my life. You know, either we're raising that aware society, or we can just cower in ignorance and hide the books behind the shelves and let people sign out permission slips for their intellectual curiosity.
We need to sign off our webcast just a second. I just wanted to remind you that this program has been webcast by the New York Public Library. There are additional questions which we can continue after the webcast ceases. I'd like to welcome those watching on the web to send any questions or comments about the program to dmc@nypl.org, dmc@nypl.org. And reminder that Free Speech Zone will be on display through October 2nd at Donnell Library Center at 20 West 53rd Street between 5th and 6th Avenue in Midtown Manhattan. Thanking all of our partners and all of the authors, this is Marie Nestis wishing a good evening to our web audience from Donnell. Thank you.